can I just check this or can I just verify that? So, you know, in a sense, I think people found that draining, but it was for all of the best. When I say people, I mean, I think her contacts must have found it stressful and draining. But on the other hand, it was for a good reason. And Michelle's reporting, you go back and look at some of those stories from those days, and you know, they are factually detailed in a way that some of the big picture analytical stuff that you also wrote, or that others wrote, but Michelle's approach was much more to accumulate that granular detail, and she did that very well. So ferocious work ethic. Now I learned from her what it is to be a chief political correspondent. That word political, what did that mean? Well, you know, if I was doing a social security story, but if the social security story got big, she would intervene. She would take it over because it moved out of the policy realm into the political realm. You know, I mean, the rule of thumb, if the Prime Minister was interested in it, well, then the Chief Political Correspondent is interested in it. And it has to be said, Michelle was often the source of frustration and angst and dissatisfaction on the part of some of those number twos that I just mentioned before, in particular, for quote-unquote stealing stories. That was the word that was used. And I've tried to explain why I can see the frustrations that it caused. It was because of her perception of politics. And actually, that was a lesson, you know, what is operating at the level of politics rather than at the level of policy.
Tell me, the work you did and on your rounds, and was it vetted by her or by anybody else before you actually submitted it to the paper?
Well, the process, there was a typical news gathering process which would apply whether we were in the Melbourne office or whether we were in Canberra. I mean, the morning chief of staff, Nigel Balfe, would ring up in the morning and would usually talk to the number two and say, what's on, what are you expecting, what have you got? And if Melbourne had any requests for us. But an early news list is prepared on that basis. And then down in Melbourne, the news editors and the editors are refining their ideas during the day. I guess there's an afternoon news conference where final decisions are made about what's going where. But the critical element for me as a reporter, for any reporter in that news process, was towards the end of the day, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, you would get a phone call from the news editor. The news editor would ring the bureau and he'd, you know, talk to each of us in turn. What have you got? What's your story? And you'd explain it. And that was where you were subject to, you know, tough questioning, but also where you had to strut your stuff and sell the story, as it were, to the news editor.
So did you, within the bureau here in Canberra, did you get together for regular sort of sessions to talk about these kind of issues?
I've got to tell you, I mean, regular get-together. We are stuck in this tiny room together. So there was no need for any formal meeting. I mean, the room, seven of us, it was, what, half the size of this room that we're in now. Mm. I reckon less than half. I don't know how we squeezed in. It was so you would always be aware of what every person was doing. You'd hear their phone calls.
Yeah.
You'd hear, you know, Walker talking to the news editor, and like you didn't have to wait to be told. Everything was, in a sense, it was highly efficient. I think it was pretty stressful as well. But, you know, so there was no kind of process involved really beyond that. Occasionally, Michelle would be made aware of something and say, Cobber, you know, you should look at this or that. Mm. Yeah. So she was certainly, you know, across the process for sure.
More general question, The Age would have an editorial policy, I would assume. And I wondered if such a policy, in which way would it this affect your reporting and the work you did? Were there any constraints? Did they have any guidelines for what they were after or what they didn't want to know about? In a sense, something that restricts your area of operation?
It's not really so much an editorial policy. I mean, yes, the age did have a broad editorial policy, and it was, you know, articulated in the editorials. Creighton Burns was the editor for most of my time that we're talking about. Graham Perkin died, who was the editor of The Age, in the Christmas of 75, just prior to my starting at The Age, so I didn't serve under Perkin. But there was still that Perkin kind of crusading element about it. Creighton Burns was a pretty gutsy kind of guy, highly intelligent, articulate. So you knew the overall kind of position of The Age, but it didn't really operate as a constraint that I was aware of as a day-to-day reporter. More important, I think, were the news priorities that would be articulated from time to time by the news editor or by some of the senior, you know, editorial types. I can remember, for example, when I was posted to Canberra, not as a sessional, but as a full-time member, and I had a meeting with Peter Smark, since sadly passed on. Smark was a wonderful writer and a great enthusiast for news. He was very keen, and I know other journalists have been told this before going up to Canberra, but he was his message to me was, look, the Bureau is based in Parliament House, but we want you to get out of Parliament House. We want you to get out of Parliament House and go and report the departments. We want you to go and find all of these stories which are outside, you know, not just the ins and outs of the politics, but we want to get into the real news where policy is being made in the departments. And that was the mandate, you know, that was the mission. Easier said than done. And as I say, I don't think I was Robinson Crusoe in being told that. I think lots of news editors have told their aspiring young journalists to get out of Parliament House. But in those days, The Age was a much more policy-focused paper. I think this is probably the better answer to your question, Edward. I think it wasn't so much about broad political constraints, but we were tasked with policy reporting, and we would, you know, as policy would develop in immigration or social security, and there were budget issues and there were policy issues and there were questions of new programs and projects being developed by these departments, and I had to get across them, and we would write, you know, 12 or 15 paras of a night about some social security policy as it was evolving from the department, if you could get hold of it. And those kinds of stories are not reported these days, I have to say. Two reasons. One is the newspapers aren't interested in. Second, the departments have basically shut down the outlets. You know, I could go in and talk to a deputy secretary. That was the job as a journalist. You would go and build up your contacts, you would build their trust, you could talk to them, go out to, you know, the old Benjamin offices out at Belconnen, as I did. Also no longer with us. And talk to them off the record, but get facts, and the departments, I mean, that just no longer happens.
That must have been, and since that obviously was a significant part of, the important part of your job, how did you develop those contacts and how did you get them? After all, the bureaucracies are rather large and in many cases rather anonymous.
Yeah, well, Michelle was very helpful in that regard. Michelle had fabulous, just fabulous contacts everywhere, in the departments, in the party organisations, in the ministerial offices. So she was helpful, but, you know, you ring them up. At all else, you would just cold call and, you know, can I come and see you? And they would often say yes.
So would you do, a round visiting the departments on a regular basis?
Not a routine basis, but you certainly had to stay in touch, and it was important not only to be calling these guys when you needed them at 4 o'clock in the afternoon for an urgent, you know, confirmation, you could, because that's unfair on them, and it's, you know, so you had to build a relationship with them, a relationship of trust. You had to demonstrate your own bona fides. They knew more about this policy than I was ever going to know. They had to trust me that I wasn't going to screw them, you know, that I wasn't going to make some blunder. It was probably in their interests to inform me a little bit so that I didn't make a blunder, which would then be up to them to clear up.
The other organisations in Canberra, paper journalist organisations and press gallery organisations, would presumably have people doing the same kind of job as you did. And that meant that the same public servant might be approached by many, a large number of individuals who all want to have the same information.
Well, maybe, but I mean, this, your skill as a journalist was to get it first, or to have a good source that nobody else had. And just going back to that point about reporting policy, we competed on policy. So if the Herald had a story in my area, I got a kick in the pants, you know, if I didn't have it myself. So there was competition for this, you know, there was a progressive development of stories, you know, and it was competition is great in journalism. You know, competition is an enormously productive engine of knowledge.
I was actually going to ask about that just now. What's the relationship like between the various groups and individuals working in the press gallery? Was there cooperation at any point, or were you all, as you were just describing, in a sense, looking for that exclusive?
Well, it was both. I mean, there was cooperation and there was competition. So, I mean, really interesting question. So in a sense, the physical arrangement of the press gallery, first of all of the Fairfax papers were together, all of the News Limited papers were together, Radio Alley was all together. So there was a sense in which the corporate or commercial structures of the news organisations was presumed to lead to greater collaboration. And at two levels, at the news level, which is what we're talking about, but perhaps more importantly in terms of corporate services. So there was, you know, shared filing, shared telex communications arrangements and so forth. So that made sense to co-locate, you know, the Fairfax papers in the Fairfax corridors. But no, we competed. But we, you know, mate, look, I didn't get the press conference, or my tape broke, or I didn't get this. Can you give us a, you know, or, you know, say three people have gone to the same press conference. Now, you're all going to type up the one? No, I'll type it up and I'll give you copies of, you know, the transcript and stuff like that. So there were efficiencies. People would cooperate to just lighten the load. But if you had a story, I mean, if you had a story, you had to keep it confidential. You sometimes wouldn't even tell other people in the bureau. I mean, I don't want to emphasize that. You certainly wouldn't tell people in other bureaus. If you were working on a good story, you would keep it quiet, and then they would get the surprise when they read the paper. That was the whole point of it.
So what I'm hearing is that the even papers within the same group, so the Fairfax group, they were competing against one another.
Oh, too right. Yes. Stories. Yes. Yes. We were for news, yes. But in a you know, against the backdrop of collaboration on some of the efficiencies. Let me also say that, you know, again, as I talk about the physical co-location, but also in this building as well, you know, it's not as if you could get away from people if you wanted to. We're all thrown in together in the press gallery. We would then all go down to lunch down next to the canteen. We used to call it Laszlo's because there was this, I think, Hungarian chef. I think he was a chef. He may just have been I don't know. It was pretty dreadful. But Laszlo's, we would all storm down there and take your tray along. And, you know, you'd sit often with other journos, you know, you would just sit there and chew the fat and catch up on the day. Literally chew the fat. But no, you would talk about what was going on. You know, Michelle would sit there with Laurie Oakes and with Paul Kelly, and they'd chat. And you know, important stage, I think, in opinion formation. And probably those social arrangements actually were quite critical, I think, in the press gallery as a whole coming to formulate views. Now, we're not talking about who's got a scoop. They would certainly not disclose that, but they would certainly share perspectives on the overall state of the government, the overall state of a minister, whether a minister, quote-unquote, had to go, you know, if there was some scandal running, if there was some... you know, whether the opposition's line of attack on something was credible or not working, you know, these kinds of issues were chatted about over the tables at Laszlo's. And, you know, as I say, I think that was actually quite an important stage of opinion formation. Whether that happens in the new building, I don't think it can. New building's larger. There's no Laszlo's. And they probably are busier as well, you know. We thought we were busy then, but one deadline per day compared to what they're doing now.
The impression you get reading today's newspapers compared to the time that we're talking about now is that they're all papers within the same group print the same material with very little difference.
Yeah.
That didn't happen back in the days you were working there.
No, they were quite different products. They would occasionally share copy, but copy sharing arrangements were controversial, were frowned on, and were... No, I beg your pardon, not... That's probably overstating it. They were special. Copy would be shared on special occasions across the Fairfax papers, but typically the Canberra bureaus were there to compete and to provide their own coverage to their own papers, on the argument that, you know, we were a Melbourne paper, so we were going to be much more interested in the Melbourne ministers, Melbourne opposition people, you know, and a Victorian perspective on policy than the Sydney people were.
Talking a bit more, but get sort of the mundane, if such a thing is really exists in this world. What was a typical day like for you as a member of the press gallery back in this period? When did you start work and just walk through, let's call it an ordinary day?
Yeah. Certainly listen to radio news in the morning, you know, whatever else had happened. I must admit, in my later years, we got into the habit of taping AM and listening to it at a more civilised hour, like 8:30 in the morning. That was pretty civilised. But no, you'd get some kind of a idea of what had happened from the radio, and you would certainly consume all of the newspapers, you know, at the beginning of the day. But you wouldn't actually front at the office until... 10:30, 11, something like that. You wouldn't be expected, you know, before then. You might have had, you know, if you were working on something, you might have been out and about, you might have gone somewhere to do an interview. But there wouldn't have been much happening, you know, before, as I say, 10:30, 11. 10:30, 11 would be when this first phone call happens with the Melbourne office about what's going on. There would be lunch, and sometimes that might be like a formal press club lunch, say, where there was an event, but often it was just lunch where you would go off and you know, to a restaurant perhaps, or you know, down here to Laszlo's, and talk about stuff. You would actually begin the news gathering, I guess, you know, during the afternoon. But it often wasn't until, you know, our deadlines were so late, you know, compared to now, we would not really start writing until late afternoon. 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, okay, it's busy. But you know, you're filing, you know, and that's when you're filing your news for a deadline, which was, you know, perhaps well, it depends on what page it was going in, but a page one deadline wouldn't have been till, you know, 9 p.m. or something like that. Again, it seems fantastic compared to pages today, which get locked up at, you know, 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Mm. Did The Age have more than one edition at that time?
Yeah, definitely. There was a first edition, and then it would be, it could be remade for the second. And the first edition was the country edition, so it was the one that we actually got here in Canberra, but it was only a small, relatively small circulation. The big one was the late edition, the second edition. Sometimes a third, if there was, you know, some special cause, but typically there were two editions, and the second edition was the one which would circulate in Melbourne you know, would be the big circulation one.
And your deadline for you would have to obviously observe deadlines for all editions.
Yeah. Oh gosh, Edward. I mean, you could get stuff into the paper at 10 o'clock at night, and did. But it was, you had to make Melbourne aware that something was coming. But they could hold a space for you if you were reliable. You know, you'd put it in. You could sometimes, you know, phone copy in direct to the office. Sometimes direct to the Stone, and you know, it could be put in. Small corrections, you know, extra paragraphs could be put in late at night, 11, you know, 12. But as I say, those late editions are special arrangements. Certainly the concept of the first and second edition was absolutely set in cement, and, you know, if you got it in the first edition, you could then rewrite it for the second.
And this was our daily routine.
Yeah.
So when would your working day normally finish?
9. But occasionally there'd be, you know, there'd be dinner, maybe. Well, I can remember when I was a cadet in the Melbourne office, so back in 1976 when I started, I was on what was called a 2 to 11 shift. It started at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Work through to 11. You say 2 to 11, you know, I mean, for most journalists that day, they would miss every edition if they were working 2 to 11. But as a junior staff, I was required to stay back to 11, and you would monitor the radio news, the ABC news, and if there was anything on the news. So there was a reason to stay there until 11. And commercial news as well. You were monitoring the news, and you would just keep the news desk informed if there was stuff happening quite late. So, I mean, we would go to dinner up to the Golden Age Hotel or some of the other ones around there, have a steak, have a couple of beers, and then go back to the office and continue working. I mean, it sounds fantastic. It was fantastic. But, you know, you would still be doing important, relevant work at 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night. Mm. And in Canberra, look, if there was something on, you know, you were there until stumps. You were there until it finished. You might be going down to the non-members bar, or you might be moving around the building. But there was, there was nothing else to do. It was work. It was fantastic. It was exciting. So you stayed there.
How would you describe the working conditions in this building? And, you know, what was it really like to be in the press gallery back in those years?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. So working conditions. I mean, well, I'll say, first of all, I loved this building. I loved working in this building. I loved the access. I loved King's Hall, where everything would happen. I'd love the press gallery. You'd just constantly be bumping into people. So its small size was a real benefit. But I have to say, I mean, I think back, so the flip side of that small size was that it was extremely crowded. And so, you know, if I could just describe the noise in this bureau at, say, 6 o'clock at night. So you've got 7 journos in there on typewriters, okay? hammering away because, you know, we're all busy at that stage in this tiny little room. The radio is going because we're constantly monitoring ABC. We would have it on ABC News and PM, the radio program, public affairs program. PM was a major event for us. They reported a lot of politics and so forth. So the radio's going. This air conditioning is going because it's very fuggy in there. It's hot. People talk on telephones. You could hear every conversation, you know, if you wanted to. It was just this intense. And the squawk box, of course, you know, if Parliament's sitting, you've got the little parliamentary speakers going. So just this noise, and it was actually exhilarating. Sometimes I can remember thinking, this is fabulous, you know, because there's just the sense of excitement and energy in the place. We're typing on sheets of paper, and we are, I've just got to say a little bit about the technology here. So this is being telexed down to the Melbourne office, and the telex offices were, you know, in the Fairfax corridor. So just outside our door, there was the corridor, and then on the other side of the door, there was this minute office where there were two big industrial telex setups, and these were manned by the guys who actually worked over in the old, is it West or East Block? But there was where the archives building is.
East
Block. That was a post office there, and their day jobs were as telex operators there, and they would come over to the press gallery at night. Wonderful guys. Wal Merriman was this very unflusterable fellow. And there was another guy called Curly, who was a really kind of knockabout bloke. But they were... so obviously the telex machine's adding to the noise. They're typing our stories and retyping them and sending them down to Melbourne. At the same time, of course, there's an incoming telex. You'd have an AAP wire service or telex service coming in with the AAP news service, which would occasionally, you know, produce the meters and meters of stuff which would get torn off. And, you know, if there was a relevant story or a press release or something, you know, these pieces of paper would be passed around the office to you. So the noise, the rekeying of stuff, the paper-based, you know, there was press releases, there was bits of telex copy all around the place. So, you know, messy and chaotic, and as I say, pretty thrilling, I must say.
How did you? I mean, you did you say? I think there were seven of you in the same the small space. How did did you all get along? I mean, didn't you, were there no times when you got on each other's nerves and perhaps were prevented from doing your job simply by the level of noise and other interruptions?
Well, not that I recall, no. I suppose it's strange, but, you know, I mean, it was, they were great guys to work with, and I say mostly guys. I mean, I was succeeded by Kate Legg. But with the exception of Michelle, I think it was an all-male office, which is kind of interesting.
So Michelle was in this office as well as the bureau chief?
Oh, yes.
In this same, sharing with the other six of you?
Yeah, yeah. She had a desk in the corner which was protected by a screen so that, you know, as chief political correspondent, if she was doing something super confidential, people couldn't necessarily see when they came into the office. If she was there or what she was working on. And, you know, she also had the luxury of one of those old vinyl armchairs which, you know, could sit there. And so if somebody wanted to come in, as they would occasionally, need to talk to Michelle, and they would have a close conversation kind of behind the screen, you know. So that could happen. But no, Michelle was certainly in there. You know, I mean, yeah, about seven of us. And, of course, our office assistant, Alex Zabritsky, marvellous woman. She would come in during the day. She was a very refined Polish woman, the wife of George Zabritsky from ANU, and as university students, friends of the later Pope, the Polish Pope. So Alex was a very, she would put these little cotton gloves on and snip the newspapers, keep our files. We had paper-based files on subject matters and also personal files of our, what stories we'd written, which were just invaluable research items.
So she was the eighth person in the office? Yeah, or probably, did she yeah. come in at times that you
Well, she only worked during the day, so she would...
So when you went really... all
yeah, she probably left at four or five or something like that, after having made Michelle another cup of tea. Michelle drank so much tea that sometimes she got sick of the taste and she would only drink hot water, and I thought that was just the most extraordinary thing.
You mentioned that your office was up on the Senate side, above, effectively, on and in the temporary buildings that were that were there on the Senate side. How did what was the passage like? Did you walk in, out in the open across the roof to get to the main entrance and come down into on the rep side?
Yeah, so you would walk from the press boxes. You would walk out. There's the little door that goes into the reps gallery, press gallery. Then you would take a left, and that's where it's currently blocked off. But where it's blocked off was the beginning of, they call it a catwalk, which is essentially a kind of, it was a boardwalk of slatted wood, which must have been on some iron, you know, railing or something like that. And there was, it was sheltered. There was a tin roof and kind of, you know, that kind of bottle glass. It was kind of opaque glass, but it was essentially exposed to the elements. Like, if it was a cold day, it was cold, and if it was a hot day, it was bloody hot under the tin roof. And you would go over there, and first thing on the left, there was the Prime Minister's press office. So David Barnett, Owen Mongo Lloyd, Alastair Drysdale, they worked in there. And, you know, you could drop in on them. But the catwalk continued and arrived at, well, I haven't been on the Senate side, but arrived on the Senate side near a door that went into one of the public galleries in the Senate. And so, for example, on that catwalk, you know, and you could hear Michelle... If I'm sitting in the office, you could hear Michelle in her heels, you know, coming over this hollowy sound of catwalk. You know, as I say, ferocious work ethic. I mean, she was just always on the job. But also, you know, members of the public, you know, there would be public tours and school tours coming over this catwalk sometimes to go into the, you know, to continue their tour of the chambers.
How was access to the rooms themselves? There are some. There's at least one rather strange story about that one journalist who got tried to enter through into his office on the roof, and got stuck because he wanted to try get in through the window.
Don't know. No, can't confirm that one. egress and access was strictly conventional through the doorways. There was a because there were these public tours, the Fairfax corridor was distinguished by having its own Senate guard, member of the staff, who had to sit there. World's most boring day. He would sit in the corridor on this little chair and smoke his rollies, and against the eventuality that rarely happened of members of the public turning left into the corridor rather than right into the Senate chamber, at which point he would leap up and tell them in no uncertain terms that to go away. And I forget his name. He would croak at Michelle every time. "Hi, Michelle," as she would walk past. But he was replaced by a sign saying no entry, and left nothing but this kind of nicotine stain on the glass of the corridor. It was a funny corridor. It was just long enough for corridor football, so we did play footy a little bit up and down there, and the tops of the walls were marked with bad kicks. You know, you got very close friends with your with the age people, but made a lot of friends in the Herald Bureau and the Finn Review Bureau as well. I can remember the Herald people, they were all Sydney-siders, Russell Barton, Scott Milsom, Tom Mockridge, who went on to a big career with Paul Keating and now with News Limited, Paul Kelly, Amanda Buckley. So they were all great people. I can remember once walking into that Herald Bureau and they had the TV going, and it must have been State of Origin, and it was the first time I'd ever seen rugby league played. I couldn't believe that they were actually watching it, because from an AFL background, I just thought this was utterly bizarre behaviour. But, you know, that's the acculturation of being in the national capital as opposed to the states, which were in those days much more state-like.
Did there, almost, and I think I knew, know the answer, but did, or in which way did this, the work you were doing as a journalist in the press gallery, impact on your, any social life you had?
Oh, well, it was the one and the same. Lots of young single people in Canberra, none of whom live in Canberra, or none of whom are from Canberra, all of whom are stuck in the national capital, thrown together in these, you know, intimate working environments, and so our social life was the same as well. Weekends, well, we'd often work on Sunday, but weekends, Saturdays, we would go for these country drives. We would go out for barbecues, and I remember with Patrick Walters from The Age, from The Australian, and Simon Ballston, who